Welcome to the Lovejoy Hour, sponsored by Cooker, 100 degree boiling hot water, straight from your kitchen tap. I assume in the future, everyone will have a hot water tap with chilled, filtered water coming out of it. So why not get one now and live in the future? If you can afford it, I do recommend them. Absolutely fantastic. Great bit of kit. Go to cooker.co.uk to find out more details. Cooker spelled Q-U-O-O-K-E-R. Today's Lovejoy Hour, I'm curious about the future again. It's a regular catch-up with futurist Tom Cheese, right? I've got to say, I love doing these podcasts. I absolutely love them. As regular listeners know, Tom predicts the future. He does it for himself and he does it for companies so they can work out what to do with their businesses. He just seems to know so much about what's going on. Great. Anyway, let's tell you what we're going to talk about today. We're going to cover privacy. We're going to talk about immortality. We'll talk about ownership. We'll talk about food, the future of food, food trends. We'll talk about cloning humans. That's my input. We'll talk about NFTs, non-fungible tokens, as they are called. Non-fungible tokens. Yeah. So we talk about that. We talk about all sorts of things. We cover a lot and I'm sure you're going to love it. And I must apologize because I get a little overexcited because we're talking about the future and I don't know why, but I just really enjoy talking about that. Let's meet him. Here's Tom. Tom, hello. Thank you for joining me again. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you, Tom. I'm a little bit tired and sore. I've been out working on my car in the rain all day. But other than that, I'm very good.
What car is it? What are you doing to it?
This is my lockdown project. My daughter and I built an electric car in lockdown and it started making a funny noise the other day. So I decided to take it all apart and put it all back together again.
That's fantastic. That's really good. Are you enjoying that? I would absolutely hate to do that. Do you enjoy it?
Yeah, love it. Love it. I'm a geek at heart. So things like this just give me the greatest of joy, even if I'm a bit tired and sore now. I need a hot bath.
Didn't you build your own computer at one stage as well?
I've built a few computers. Yeah. I mean, that's not that sophisticated these days, but I don't think I had a computer that I hadn't built for about 15, 20 years, probably. These days, it's all laptops, isn't it? You can't really build those very easily.
Right. Okay. First of all, I've got to congratulate you, by the way, because it looks like smart toilets are on the way. And this is something in a previous life. I had a documentary, mini documentary series on I can't remember what the channel was called then. It was 4 Online or something.
4OD.
Was that what it was? Yeah. It called that though. Then I'm not sure what it was called. Anyway, and Tom talked about smart toilets. And this, God, how many years ago was that? It's got to be 8-9 years ago, hasn't it?
Yeah, something like that. Yeah, something like that. I've got the clip somewhere. Yeah,
and he talked about it, and they're actually produced prototypes of these now. So you're gonna poo and wee into a toilet, and the toilet will analyze your waste and tell you if you're ill or not. True?
Absolutely true. There's very few better ways and actually less invasive ways to know what's going on inside you by looking at what's coming out of you. And so, you know, things like bowel cancer, you know, things like, you know, digestive disorders, there's all sorts of things we can work out, look at diabetes, all sorts of analysis we can do by sticking sensors in your loo.
And I love this because I've got a real bugbear with toilets in this country at the moment. The toilet paper really bugs me, that the idea that we're still wiping our bums with that rather than, you know, and it's that classic thing, Tom. We went to Europe and we saw bidets and everyone went, what are those for? When you find out it's for wiping your bum in, you know, washing your bum in, you're like, oh, that's disgusting. No, it's not. And then you, the Japanese toilets, which are just the greatest because you just sit there and a little lever comes out, sprays water up your bum and you wash it. And we go, oh, no, I don't like that. It's like, what, rather than washing your bum, rather than using paper? And we've still got these really old-fashioned toilets. And so I think with a smart toilet, hopefully what will happen is we'll integrate the Japanese style washing of the bum at the same time. That can't be bad for us, can it, to do a bit more hygiene?
The Trojan toilet, you know, you buy it for the health sensors and it comes with all the other gadgetry as well. And you know, we're gonna be spending a lot of money on toilets. I mean, these things are not going to be cheap. But at first, at least. But yeah, I think they're going to be normalized relatively quickly.
Yeah, because it's kind of interesting if you're going to go for a wee or a poo or something, and then you know, and it goes, the alarm goes off and says, look, you know, you're weeing out a lot of cancer cells. I assume that's what's going to happen, and then they're going to go get yourself to a doctor. It's like really early spotting of the disease. It's a great concept, isn't it? It's fantastic.
Well, particularly if you look at our changing demographics, you know, we've heard for a while now we've got an aging population, but it's really dramatic. I mean, one of my scariest stats about this, there are parts of the country that by the middle of the century, there'll be a one-to-one ratio of people of working age to people of retirement age. So we're really going to struggle for people to work in the NHS. We're going to struggle for care workers. And the, you know, the only way we can stop NHS costs spiraling, and you know, we already have a shortage of these people, is by taking better care of ourselves. And yeah, one of the ways to do that is to track your health and intervene early when it's cheap and it's straightforward, rather than late when you're going into hospital for surgery and all sorts of expensive and difficult and, you know, frankly, you know, very unpleasant treatments. So the more we can do to track these things early, the more, the less pain we're going to feel both as individuals and as a nation as we all start to age.
And I remember you telling me that a very long time ago, that it's going to be cheaper to put a smart toilet in everyone's houses than to give everybody chemo and heart surgery, which is where we're going, I suppose. So what have you been working on recently? Lots to do with immortality.
Yeah, I just got a bit of a, I don't know, I saw an article saying that I think the first people who were going to live forever had already been born. And my immediate reaction was, no, they haven't. And I was just got really interested in this whole thing about immortality. So I went and did some research. We surveyed the country and asked people about their attitudes, whether they wanted to live forever, what technologies they might be willing to partake of in order to extend their lives. I went and looked at all the technologies as well. Like, what could we actually do practically to extend our lives a long time? And the reality, because the reality is most of us aren't doing it, you know, combined with this thing about aging, 2/3 of Brits are overweight or overbeat. A third of us are obese. You know, we're not doing a lot of the stuff we could do to extend our lives. So I was very skeptical about the idea that somehow everybody wants to.
Yeah, well, it's actually interesting. I did a tweet, yeah, not a tweet, something on Instagram the other day, and the age of abundance desire is the biggest challenge for the human being, the modern human. And I think that's true. My parents lived in the war, and so they were born in the war. So they lived in and their parents before them didn't have any money. Like, I remember my granddad telling me they managed to eat meat once a week, I think, if they were lucky. And now we can have meat and chocolate and beer and wine and stuff every day. And I think the biggest problem for humans is our instincts is to gorge on stuff when it's good. And so I think that's where a lot of the problems come from. Our desire, you know, it's tough for us to abstain from just drinking or eating or just, you know, living life to the full, as it were.
Yeah, you know, our economy has evolved an awful lot faster than our biology. And so, yeah, we do. You're right. We have these instincts. I see, you know, that fatty stuff. I want it. I want to consume it. And yeah, there's all sorts of interesting studies about, you know, the balance of exercise and consumption. And apparently, yeah, people had this idea that we used to burn an awful lot more calories than we do now. Actually, we don't. We still burn as many calories, as one scientist argued, as when we were sort of hunter-gatherers. It's just that we consume an awful lot more. And so, you know, we an awful lot more that's actually easier to digest and more so nutrient rich. So we have to be, you know, we have to be careful. We have to live life in balance, as my kids are very bored of me telling them.
Yeah. So what are these people saying about immortality then? So how are we getting there? Just because medicine's getting so good?
Yeah, I mean, that's what's driven the increase in average age until now. It's basically our comprehension of the human body. We stopped allowing lots of people, both children and mothers, to die in childbirth. That had a dramatic effect. We fed people a lot more, a lot better. We sort of, you know, got to grips with the idea of bacteria and started to deal with that, and then slowly started to tackle some of the more complex killers. Oh, health and safety as well is quite important. You know, we actually started putting fences up around giant saws and, you know, big cliffs and things, and stopping people falling off those. So, you know, we did all this sort of relatively rudimentary stuff, but now it gets tricky because we're bumping up against biology now. We're bumping up against the limits of our understanding of the human body. And so you're starting to see these incredibly sophisticated treatments. You know, we've seen the study of the impact of the human papillomavirus vaccine recently, which I think has cut levels of cancer in the women who'd had it very dramatically. We've seen these sort of new genetically targeted treatments for a variety of diseases starting to come through. You know, one of those things where 20 years ago we saw the promise, and we're finally starting to see those things emerge as realistic treatments. But then it gets into really, when you start to look to the future, it gets into one of two categories. It's biological interventions. Can we understand the mechanism of aging and reverse it? And that gets involved in, gene therapies and blood transfusions. There are people already having blood transfusions from younger people in a bid to rejuvenate themselves. So we do have vampires. And then it's about technology. It's, if we can't extend the life of the human body, and particularly the healthy life of the human body, do you want to shift your brain into something else, or shift your consciousness into a computer or a robot, or live in virtual reality forever? And people have varying attitudes to those things.
See, I always say that if an alien comes here, it's not going to be an alien, is it? It's going to be a computer. It's going to be a robot or something, and it's probably just going to be code. I wonder if we're slowly turning ourselves into code. That's what we're doing. We're slowly integrating with our smartphones and our computers, and I think we've discussed it before about the brain lace or something, the cranium lace or something that Elon Musk wants to invest in, where we become our machine. We're half machine, half computer, smartphone. So I can see us going that way, where we're at the end of being a human being and we're evolving into a machine. How far away are we from doing that, do you think?
I don't know. I mean, in some ways, I'd say we're all cyborgs already. The level of reliance we have on our smartphones now, and the ease of use of them is so great now that I don't think there's an awful lot of difference between a chip in your brain and a chip in your hand at the moment. I'm incredibly reliant on it for navigation and memory and all sorts of other stuff. In terms of actually implanting things, well, we can do it today in an experimental scenario, primarily as a medical treatment for people who've lost sort of motor function, or trying to manage epilepsy or restore sight in rudimentary ways. In terms of as a consumer, a consumer piece of technology as an alternative to a smartphone, I'm quite skeptical about that. You think about how fast this technology moves. Do we really want to be ripping our brains open every 18 months to install a new iPhone? I think that's unlikely. So I think quite some time until there is a neural lace that you get from your mobile phone provider or your telecoms provider. I would suggest probably 30 years.
Yeah, well, you say that. If you get a Tesla, and there's another car someone was talking about the other day, that their car is actually, it was another electric car. Their car has got faster, more efficient since they bought it, because they keep just sending over the cloud into their cars updates. So the Tesla definitely is doing that. It's getting better all the time, even the older models. So I suppose what you would do is you would have a bit of tech in your head. And I actually imagine it wouldn't be implanted in your head, by the way. I imagine for the fact that they can get to your heart via your groin and up your wrist, or I imagine it would go somewhere where you don't possibly need it, maybe like a top of your groin or something. And they could just keep on updating that, put in a new one and just send it wirelessly for your information.
Yeah, you can update the software, but it's much harder to update the hardware. And you look at Tesla's a great example. Compare a Model S to a Model 3, and the quality of the technology, the level of integration. Look at Tesla's next generation batteries, this new battery format they're bringing out. They're going to have, it's going to make an original sort of Model S, or even an early Tesla Roadster, look like an antique. And the same thing, and that we're only talking about a difference of 10 years. And so the same thing will happen with these neural laces. Even though you can update the software and you can make the old one better, you can't make it anywhere near as good as something that's been purpose-built with the latest technology. The exception to that rule is, if when we do get to an age of nanotechnology where we can effectively, reprogram stuff at a molecular level and dynamically reconfigure it, reshape it, by remote control with sort of, robots. Do you remember you're the right vintage like me to remember a film called Inner Space? where they shrunk these sort of people in these exoskeletons down, and they were zooming around in somebody's bloodstream. If we can shrink people down, we wouldn't be shrinking people. If we can build robots to molecular level, we can reprogram to change the composition of this neural lace and upgrade it over time. Then absolutely, get it in there. You can fix it all. You can fix it anytime you like. But again, I come back to this idea whether we need it. We're so good at interpreting what we want now. Do we really need to plug into our brains in order to capture that? When actually, we're getting to the point where we're an AI between picking up your breathing rate, your heart rate, your galvanic skin response, like your sweat, basically, your pupil dilation. They know what you're enjoying. They know if you're healthy. They know if you're doing exercise. They know all sorts of stuff about you. It's a question of how much we actually need to plug something directly into the brain.
Yeah, I love this conversation. I just love talking to you because I love talking about the future. Interestingly, I think that if with my smartphone, I would be go back to 1950, if I had my smartphone, it worked like it did now, I'd be bearing in mind we'll judge it on knowledge. If we were judging it on knowledge, alone, I'd be the smartest man in the world, wouldn't I? If I had a smartphone, that's how far it's come. There'd be no one smarter than me if I had my smartphone around, because that's the knowledge I've got in my hand now, isn't it? So it's amazing.
It's really shifted what we need. I have this conversation with employers quite a lot. What do you want from the next generation of the workforce coming through? How much do you really care about what they know? What knowledge is stored in their head, because it makes them great at trivial pursuits and maybe more interesting to talk to at coffee break. But actually what you really want is the skills of discovery and qualification. What you want is the ability to say, okay, I don't know the answer to that, but I can find it quickly and make sure that what I find is true, not false. And knowledge helps with that. But actually, knowing the capitals of the world is the names of all the Tudor kings and queens or whatever is not particularly helpful.
Yeah, By the way, recently I went to see a doctor and they were saying, well, we might have to do one of those. Are they called endoscopes or
endoscopy,
something, where they stick up your bum.
Yeah.
And I went, oh, okay. And they said, actually, these days they can just throw a camera down your throat and you swallow it and you do it that way. And I was like, what? And they was like, hold on a second. They say you just swallow like a little pill. So the stuff you're talking about is kind of, things just move very quickly. Just before we move on from immortality, though, what interests me is I wonder if it's rather than the machine coming into us, we start entering the machine. We start taking our brain and going, okay, we're coming to the end of our age. We're 90 years old. And I feel like we're judging you. You feel like you've got dementia coming on at Alzheimer's. Let's take your healthy brain and somehow get that going into a computer. That must be a way that we're thinking, rather than, us, the computer coming into us, we're going into the computer.
So I can tell you now, not many people are up for that. Based on my survey, about 2,000 adults in the UK, 16% of people said they'd be either up for transplanting their brain to a robot body or living forever in virtual reality. I can tell you now, we don't have the technology to do that. But even if we did, it doesn't appeal to... I mean, most people told me that, I think the biggest group said they just wanted to live to their natural age. Only 15% of people said they want to live forever.
Yeah, I think you're supposed to be born and then you're supposed to die. And in between, it's up to you what you do with it. Just be careful with religious leaders, politicians, and marketing men, because they can lead you astray. It's your life apart from when they get involved. Would you want to do it? Would you want to get connected online? Would you like to be online constantly?
With one caveat, yes, and it's the obvious boring caveat, which is I would, if the people I love weren't with me, I'd really miss them. But I am so curious. I'm like you. I mean, I'm always trying to learn stuff. I'm always interested. There's new skills I want to develop, sports I want to try, foods I want to eat. There's way more than I can possibly fit into a natural lifespan. And so if I could, live forever to do all of those things and fulfill my curiosity, that really appeals. But still with that caveat of I wouldn't want to see the people I love sort of go by the wayside.
The thing that we're going to get onto food in a minute, which I'm excited about, but the thing is which interests me is when we're talking about staying alive forever, There is, right, so you've got a bad heart and they can go, let's do a heart transplant, you know, bad liver, heart, liver. And there's two people talking about they can now start growing them. I've done it on this podcast. People can start growing them in labs and they can grow someone's heart or someone's liver, a heart out of a pig, and then with using your cells and growing those and all that. Like in America, you've got the lunatic Hollywood lot who are cloning their dogs. The reality is we know that dog is not the same dog as the original dog, but it's got the same sort of parts of cell buildup, but it's not got the same, let's say, consciousness. Let's say the dog is conscious. Why we seem to absolutely frown upon this, but surely the greatest idea was that when clone a Tom Cheese, right? And then when your bits are running out, move the bits into your body because it's a younger thing, then you can keep the cycle going. Now everyone goes, you can't do that. That's not ethically correct. It's like, hold on, we're doing everything else. You know, we're like taking hearts out of other people and sticking them in you and stuff like that. Why is that? Why is that the sticking point? I can't quite fathom the way, work my way through that, what's right and what's wrong.
And this comes back to that whole point about, you know, the different bits of us evolve at different speeds, and our morality is still quite superstitious in some ways. And I think it will evolve. I mean, I think a really good comparison point is the debate around assisted dying. You know, it was absolute, you know, there was an absolute moratorium. It would be inconsiderable not that long ago. And now we're sort of reaching this tipping point where society's going, okay, yeah, you know, I sort of understand. And you can see at a point in the none too distant future where it becomes, you know, a largely unacceptable practice in a lot of places. I think the same thing will happen with these sorts of conversations, where we'll get more sophisticated about our understanding of what is a person. You know, what point, when are they alive? When are they conscious? When are they when do they have rights? And I think we will get more sophisticated about that over time. Right now, I don't think we understand enough to be sophisticated. I'm quite glad we're a little bit sort of primitive about it, because I just don't think we understand enough stuff, a lot of stuff, to make some sensible decisions. But in the future, I think we absolutely will. And I think we will get much more comfortable with that sort of technology.
I did a great podcast about death with Catherine Mannix, who's a palliative nurse. She's written a great book on it. It's a very tough subject to talk about death, though. People get very angry about it. There's a lot of pushback when you start talking about either being pro or anti-assisted death. Tom, if people want to read your report, where can they go to read that on your immortality?
Oh, I mean, tomcheesewright.com. I have the simplest domain name in the world, tomcheesewright.com, and you'll find it there. You'll find I mean, I write about all sorts of topics, but it's very easy to find that report from the website.
Perfect. Let's talk about food. Let's wander onto that, because that interests me, because that's obviously got a lot to do with health as well. And I've got some thoughts on food. You've been working on it as well. So tell me what you've been working on, and then I'll do my predictions for you.
Yeah. So I've been working. I mean, so, you know, companies ring me up and say, Tom, what does the future of X look like? And I don't pull out a crystal ball. I have a series of sort of business processes and structured thinking, if you like, and I come back with some answers for them. And this year I've done quite a lot on food. In the past, I've worked with the likes of Kellogg's, and this year I've been working with Pepsi and with Mars, and most recently with Bidfood, who, a name you might not know, but if you've ever eaten in a pub, or if you've ever eaten in most restaurants, actually, you've eaten their stuff. And so I was working with them to look at, like, what are the big food trends for actually the very near future, for the next year or so, looking a bit further out as well, but looking at sort of 2022 and the sorts of things you can expect to see in pubs and restaurants, and things that might be good ideas for them to start to introduce to fit with what we want as a society.
And what have you found?
So, I mean, really split it into two in terms of the big food trends. One is despite what I said about us, you know, so many of us being overweight and obese, we have these strong health ambitions at the moment. We want to eat healthily, and you know, combine that with the sort of, you know, peer spread craze of veganism, plant-based diets, and also the sort of lots of sort of raw and fresh and natural and, you know, high quality ingredients and very simple food. And, you know, when you look at all those trends, and, you know, you start to say, well, actually, which cuisines fit that? We're probably going to see a big drive towards Peruvian, and you're starting to see more Peruvian restaurants pop up. Your Filipino, You're starting to see sort of poke bowls and things like that, which, you know, these nice spreads, nice mixes of very fresh, very real raw ingredients. And Nordic, you know, lots of Nordic places starting to spread from the high-end Michelin restaurants. We saw that the Nordic countries won a lot of Michelin stars for a few years. We've had a lot of Nordic coffee shops come into the UK. I think in the next few years, we'll see a lot more sort of Nordic influence on more of your sort of your standard pub and restaurant menu. But then at the other end, it's like we still want stuff that sort of fills us up, something that's very simple, that makes good use of cheap ingredients. And one of the cuisines we really haven't explored that much is Burmese. I'm lucky that Neela, who used to run a stall at the end of my road on the market and now actually has her own cafe, introduced me to Burmese food a few years ago, and very good it is too. Yeah, really, that's sort of somewhere between sort of Chinese and Indian, very familiar formats, but really tasty. And really, if you've ever worked in food service, and I have, I spent two summers first working and then running a hotel kitchen. What you really want is stuff that's easy to dress up, like really easy to serve up and really easy to dress up as it goes out of the kitchen. And it ticks all those boxes as well.
I've had Burmese food, unbelievably good. I've actually got a Burmese cookbook downstairs.
Yeah.
And I should dig it out because I've forgotten how good it was.
You're on trend, Tim.
it was unbelievable. I was lucky enough. I'm lucky because of my show, I get to taste so much food. I've also had Peruvian food. And again, that is off the scale good. It's just the flavors are so delicious. They use a lot of fresh ingredients. And I mean, it's just incredible. So I have a prediction on food because being on TV, I noticed that a lot of the celebrity doing, you know, obviously there's cooking on the show, that a lot of the celebrities who come on now, I think very few of them don't have some form of eating requirements. So there's a lot of them are plant-based. They call themselves vegan, but they're still wearing the leather shoes. So I imagine they're plant-based. There's a big fight between those, aren't there? Plant-based and vegan. A big fight between everyone. We've got a lot of pescatarians coming on, a lot of gluten-free, blah, 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 blah. And I don't know whether these people are doing it because they've been told they do it or they've just read the information on it. But a lot of people are coming on now. And I think that if you're looking at that lot, they've got money, top of the pyramid. It's filtering down. And I think there's a lot of people going to start looking more into health food. And so I've been... because I go online a lot, I get a lot of, advertising, which is aimed at me. What's that called?
The targeted ads.
A targeted ad. And it seems because I don't know why I look up a lot of stuff about swimming. I'm trying to improve my swimming and stuff like that. So I'm getting a lot of adverts for these drinks, not protein drinks, these drinks which have everything in them. And it's pulling me in because they're saying for £1.47 or something, I get a drink every day that gives me everything I need for the day. Now, I know years ago we had Slim Fast and all that sort of rubbish and everyone went, oh, I'm not interested in it. But these drinks, the way they're marketing, there's one big one called Huel, which is human fuel. And the way it's marketed at me, it's flashing at me. I'm desperate to try this stuff, but I don't believe it at the moment that I get everything I need. But I'm thinking, hold on, if I get at lunchtime everything I need for £1.47, then my evening meal is a bonus. I can do what I want because I know I've got everything in that meal. And to me, that seems like a really good deal.
Yeah, do you know, I mean, this part of it really appeals to me in that sort of, you know, going back to my childhood and, you know, food pills and all this sort of futuristic stuff. It's kind of the modern equivalent of that. And I can sort of say, like, 20-something Tom would have really liked it, you know, flat out, working far too many hours. You know, give me something nutritious, that sort of fills a hole at that point. 40-something Tom says, like, I really enjoy every opportunity to eat. Like, and I'll be honest, you know, I spend a good amount of time over my lunch, a good amount of time over my dinner. And, if I can, I spend a good amount of time over my breakfast as well. And they're all pleasurable experiences. Now, I have the luxury of time. And so it doesn't appeal, but I sort of understand. I sort of get it. But for me, there's no meal I don't enjoy.
And well,
it
would just...
I feel
sure
like I was missing out.
But I'm not sure it's a time thing. Yeah, but you can have one great meal a day. I'm not sure it's a time thing. I think it's a thing of like all these people sitting around taking their multivitamins every day. Rather than that, people, if they could guarantee that everything I needed, I got my fiber, I got my vitamin C, I got my vitamin D, I got my iron, my magnesium every day, my in a drink, I'd be like, well, hold on a second. This seems like a good deal. And then what I do in the evening, no one gives a shit because I've eaten that. Then the other side of it is there's this other thing which is happening at the moment, which is the alternative protein, which I've done a podcast on this, because it's this kind of tofu type brewery type thing, you know, as well as the stuff being grown in labs, which people are saying, which is made out of actual meat. People are saying they're not quite sure of. I think what the future really involves is nondescript protein, which you flavor. So I've been experimenting a lot with tofu, and I'm on board. I mean, I love tofu. You could do whatever you like with it. So you just take nondescript protein. Tofu doesn't taste for anything, mama. And you just put flavors on it. So I think there can be a growth in the artificial protein market. What do you think about that?
Yeah. So this is one of the things we looked at in this report. And I think the challenge is this tension between a desire, particularly at the high end, for fresh, for natural, for unprocessed, versus this desire for plant-based, for people who haven't really got the palate or the budget for that sort of fresh and natural. And so you end up in these sort of very highly processed foods that are potentially A, not that healthy, even though they are plant-based, and B, not necessarily that good for the environment either. And so you end up with this sort of real tension where, totally, like, you know, my youngest daughter's vegetarian. Like, if I'm trying to feed her, I'm not always going to be able to feel just vegetables. It's, you know, plant-based meatballs and, you know, plant-based sausage rolls and everything else, which is great. But are they really healthy? I mean, and given how much processing goes on, how much energy goes into them and some of these alternative proteins, are they actually good for the planet as well? And I think there's going to be a bit of a shakeout over the next few years. I think you're right. I mean, I think definitely most proteins are better than meat, you know, quite possibly for us, and definitely for the planet when you look at water consumption, energy consumption in terms of their growth. I think there'll be a lot more of that. And as we get more sophisticated at making them really fun and tasty, brilliant. But I do think there'll be a bit of a backlash in a few years' time when people start to go, hang on a minute, you sold me this plant-based diet. This was meant to make me healthier and I'm still obese. What's going on here?
Yeah, well, you mix it with the huel and then you've got the crispy tofu and you've got the actually it's interesting. Chris Wadrop, who's involved in that industry, does the podcast with me, and he's done it once. I'll get him back on in the future, but it's a fascinating industry. I seem to remember he's saying they were making protein out of air, so they were taking the carbon out of the air and doing something with it and making protein. At the moment it's only for animal feed, but that eventually it could be a way that we end up feeding ourselves. Just finally on this, I'm absolutely fascinated as well by the tricks we're playing with ourselves. I keep talking about it because I'm obsessed with it. There's this new thing. I should just buy one and see what it's like. There's this new thing called Air Up, which is also being targeted at me constantly. And it's a water bottle, but in the rim where you drink from, there's a scented thing. So it's scented orange or lemon. And I think, or lime. And as you drink it, you smell the orange and then you believe you're drinking orange, lime or lemon. Now, I thought, wow, if we could work on, I mean, this thing's selling, apparently. I know a couple of people have got one. If we could do that with food as well, we can give everybody really healthy food and make it taste like Big Mac or whatever the hell people want to, you know, the food that they, the fried food. Give it the smell, but give it that the actual stuff you're eating is healthy.
Yeah, but I think it's a lovely idea. The problem is the complexity of the food experience. Like when you're just drinking and there's no real texture to speak of, unless you're drinking, you know, a smoothie or something. And so you can just add that flavor because by your sort of feeding smells in through your sort of into your olfactory bulb. But when you're eating, so much of the experience is about texture. Yeah, there's that, and sound as well. I mean, you know, you've seen these sort of food scientists, you know, showing that actually how much noise a crisp makes when it breaks in your mouth defines how crispy you think it is. So if you can't hear it crunch,
yes,
you think it's soft, you think it's stale, and so it's very hard to replicate that. I mean, the many joys of a Big Mac just by sort of feeding yourself smells, unfortunately. But, you know, I have no doubt that in the future we'll work out more ways to trick ourselves. And the better we get at understanding the human body, and I still think we're constantly overestimating how much we understand it, but the better we get at tricking it, the more sort of tricks like that we can pull.
Yeah, well, we'll move on from this. But my prediction is, just so everyone has got this on record, I'm watching guys in gyms and girls constantly shaking up protein drinks or whatever. They're drinking their milkshakes. And I'm watching people in those offices as well. They've always got powdered drinks they're shaking and drinking. And I work in one of those sort of, workspaces where it's full of startups and people in trendy outfits. And they're always drinking these drinks constantly. And so I think we're one step away from people going, I'm going to have a drink instead of a meal. And it being a massive, massive thing. I can see at the moment it's probably a tiny percentage of what people are consuming. I think it's going to grow in a huge way as soon as they can start proving that it's giving you what you need for the day. So there's my prediction. Let me go on to the next thing I want to talk about, which is privacy. I think privacy, is a thing of the past now, isn't it? I'm just watching things play out constantly in the news and social media. And I was shocked to find out the other day that there's a setting on your iPhone that you can leave your iPhone on the side and it will anonymously tape. You've got your own spyware in your phone. So I can stand there, leave it somewhere, and it doesn't look like it's taping, but it will tape audio actually built into my iPhone now. That is horrific, isn't it?
It's really interesting thinking about privacy as a single concept. I like to look at, like, what do we mean by privacy? Private from whom? So is it our privacy with regards to each other and our peers and our friends and family? Is it privacy with regards to our relationship with the government, or privacy with regards to our relationship with big corporations? And I think all of those boundaries and all those barriers have been shifting back and forth quite a lot. In some ways, actually, our privacy with regards to big companies has been improving. You actually, quite a lot of the big companies are saying, do you know what, that big grab to own lots of data about everybody that we did over the last 20 years, it's not necessarily paying off. And the big regulators, the EU, are starting to get a bit sniffy about all this stuff we hold. We're recognizing the security risks after lots of big hacks and don't want to be sat on a database of 100,000 people and all their credit card details when it's costing me hundreds of millions to secure it every year. And then you've got that relationship with the government, which in many ways we've suddenly losing privacy. We've had the government without too much oversight, it feels, selling off NHS data, or selling access to NHS data, at least. You have to be cautious about how you term that. Still seem to be very keen on providing the law enforcement services with deep access to everything we do with minimal oversight. And then you've got our relationship with each other. And that's a really interesting one, because we've sort of seen our home lives and our sort of private lives and our public lives, particularly our home lives and our work lives, the barrier between those has started to fall a lot. People saying, bring your whole self to work. Everybody's seeing into your living room or your kitchen or your back bedroom while we've all been working from home. Not all, 43% of us at the peak, but a lot of us. All of these barriers are shifting all the time, and they're going to shift a lot more. The big technological horizon that I'm looking to at the moment, and everyone seems to be talking about it now because of Facebook rebranding to Meta, is this concept of the metaverse. What does person-to-person privacy look like when most of us are spending 10 hours a day walking around with a pair of cameras on our faces? That's a really interesting boundary for privacy.
Yeah, it was funny, actually, during the pandemic, I was discussing in North Korea, and I think some of the communist countries, they have this thing that if you get, my daughter's told me this, so it's come from them. They are studying politics, though, at university. But that if you're in North Korea and you get a prison sentence, if you die, the rest of the sentence, you haven't finished your sentence, gets passed down to your children, which is nice. Also, if you're you're someone's brother and they commit the crime and you haven't reported them, but you had knowledge, you also get the punishment as well. So I was going, how horrific is that you're going to get punished for somebody else's crime? What it does, it creates a culture of people grassing up people. And it was funny in the pandemic when we suddenly had, they're in their driveway and they've gone for three walks and you're only allowed one walk. We very quickly turned into that society where we didn't mind grassing up our neighbor, and privacy went away that way. I remember doing your exhibition on the future, which was brilliant. Brilliant, by the way. And I remember being there and you had a famous hacker there. And he was
Sammy Kamkar.
Fantastic. What a talker. And he basically said, the gist of the whole thing was, don't ever put anything out there that you don't want anyone to know, because we'll get to it, because, you know, hacking is so sophisticated now. But that seems to have eked into normal life as well. Because you're saying with the guy, you see that woman the other day kicking the horse. Mm. She was kicking and punching the horse, right? It was horrific to watch. But I went, it's a day or a week. Within a week, it's a day or 2 days before that woman has lost everything in her life. And as it happened, because we're all, you know, morally correct, all of us, we're Puritans. We look at anybody who does anything in public life or anything in right. She was just a woman, wasn't she? And then she lost her job at the pony club, and she was suspended from her. She was suspended from her job as a primary school teacher. And I imagine most of her friends are going, well, who's this? Sorry.
Yeah.
I don't know you. So it's eking its way into every aspect of our life. And, you know, I'm thinking I might get involved in balaclavas, because that that seems to be the way we're going if you want any privacy.
You know, I mean, I think maybe people were going to carry on wearing masks, you know, despite the discomfort, but just because it gives you that level of anonymity, not much, let's be honest. But, you know, I totally get this. I mean, I totally buy it. It's, you know, part of you looks at it and goes, we want people who punch horses to be uncovered.
Definitely.
And part of you goes, well, this is a sliding scale. You know, this is. There was a story the other day in the paper about one of these sort of, you know, street view cars taking photos everywhere, you know, capturing a woman flashing them in the back garden, you know, and it's, or, you know, there's all of these things that may have been, if they were news, they might have been news in the village.
Yes.
They might have been news in the parish council. And instead they're news, not just nationally, but internationally.
Yeah.
You know, and suddenly, and that has a very different impact. You know, you might have been able to ride out the storm, particularly in your parish council, where it's a bunch of your peers. Whereas you're being judged by it's not a jury of your peers when it goes, you know, viral on social media. It's a jury of everybody, and they might have very different values to you.
Yeah, exactly right. We're no longer free. We're being held accountable to everyone else. However, as you quite rightly say, there was some horrific things happening in the world, and they've always happened, but now we can film it, we can stop it happening. So it's a double-edged sword, isn't it, really? It's you know, it's some of it's good, some of it's bad. But I think if you for advice, like your mate Sammy said, is it Sammy, did he say his name?
Sammy Kamkar, yeah.
Sammy Kamkar, is don't put anything online. And also, I think we should all start living our lives now like we're on a reality TV show, because there's cameras everywhere, and you've got to make sure everything you do. Like today, some man pulled out in front of me in the car, and rather than send expletives at him, I just looked at him through the car window. Then he wound his window down and went, all right, Tim. And he knew me, and I was like, he's a friend of mine. I was like, thank God I didn't do that. He's one of my neighbors.
So, but I think that's sinking in with people. And I think, you know, you look at, you know, it's not even the next generation now, it's the generation after that. It's, you know, two generations below me, my sort of kids' age. Some of them are quite sophisticated about this. You know, they're recognizing that actually, maybe I don't want my face out there. Maybe I don't want everything I've ever done being recorded and captured. You know, maybe I do want to be able to, you know, when I'm an adult, make a decision about who I'm going to be publicly without the baggage of everything. You know, and I look at these kids, you know, whose parents are spread, you know, posting endless photos of them from the day dot, or, you know, who are, you know, creating sort of personalities on social media and TikTok. And it's like, it's brilliant. You know, in some ways it feels great. It's not like your creativity. I think it's really cool. But you've got an awful lot of baggage there that it's going to be very hard to leave behind. You know,
yeah.
I went off to university. I could be a different person to the person I was at school because nobody knew me.
Yeah.
Now, you can't do that anymore.
And I keep telling my kids, because I'm privy to this, because I'm older, is don't be too outspoken on social media, because you will scare people off. employers. You know, they want a nice, easy ride. They don't want someone who's going to be, arriving with, sorting a picket line out or something outside the work. So you've got to be very careful what you're putting out there. They also don't want people who are going to slag off celebrities constantly or whatever you're doing. So, you know, you've got to be quite benign on social media if you want to think about what you want to do in your life.
Yeah, but there's benign, and there's actually just, you know, a standard of etiquette. You know, I do think we still have this massive gap between what people are prepared to say online and what they're prepared to say in real life. Mm. And, you know, that you know, you possibly effing and jeffing out the window is very much, you know, the exception rather than the rule. Whereas lots of people who wouldn't even consider doing that are quite happy to lay into someone in the most, you know, explicit terms with the distance of two screens between them.
True. And I always say to my kids, make sure what you're putting there fits your values, and try your hardest, you know, to make sure that you're having intelligent conversations on there. It's tough to do, isn't it?
It is.
Because you want, I mean, when I was young, I wanted to rant about stuff. So, you know, and I think that's important to do too. Right. I want to get onto another couple of things quickly. So let's talk about ownership, first of all. Another one of my predictions is we're going to be renting our lives. And I did this prediction with my kids years ago. We used to play Dragon's Den, and I used to go, I'm going to sell Rent a Life. You're going to rent everything. And it was kind of a joke, but I could see it sort of maybe happening. And now it seems to me that, I'm not saying I'm as good as you, Tom, at your job, but it seems to me that the more of our lives we're renting now. So people are starting to rent their clothes, as you know. The bikes, I don't know what it's like where you live, but around London, there's bikes everywhere. Mm. There's scooters everywhere. You're renting those. There's renting cars now. That hasn't quite caught on, but I don't see a reason and why that's not going to catch on soon. I mean, it's a very, rather than me having to go and buy a car, why don't I just go out with my phone, click it, and then drive somebody else's car on their insurance and everything else, you know, and use their electricity because it's plugged into their thing. And then, you know, we can get onto, my phone's out of date. It goes out of date every year. Why can't I just rent that? Why can't I rent my computer? You know, and it takes me back to a time when I first had a flat and I rented a TV from Radio Rentals, and when it got too crap, we phoned up the bloke and they came and changed it and charged us another £3 a week or something, or month probably, and that was it. We got the updated version. Do you think we're moving towards ownership being a thing of the past and renting more stuff?
I think we are. You look at the single biggest purchase we ever make, you know, the home, and more of us are renting. Like, the fastest growing form of new housing, I think, certainly during lockdown, was build to rent. And these are really interesting things, because they're not just like you rent a flat, you're renting a lifestyle. You know, because you get the flat, you get the campus around it with the gym and the shared workspace and the cafe. You get your broadband included, all your bills are included. It's a very simplified lifestyle. It's a bit like, you know, if you've, you know, graduates coming out of university and just continuing to live on a university campus, because it's just one bill every month. There's no putting up shelves. There's no DIY. You know, there's none of this stuff. You're just basically renting a lifestyle rather than just renting a space. And, you know, you're right about the cars. The model that most of the car companies are working towards is what they call ACE, autonomous connected electric, where rather than owning a BMW, you will have a BMW subscription. And when you step out of your house, a BMW branded car will pick you up, autonomously take you where you want to go. Maybe that's the train station where your BMW pass gets you into first class rather than, you know, your standard class ticket. And when you get to London, where this is the journey I do all the time, you know, Manchester, London, and then I've got to get somewhere when I get the other end, I can either get on the tube or I can go and actually get on my BMW branded scooter, which, you know, to take me to the next place. And that's what all of the car companies are working towards. They're calling themselves mobility companies rather than car companies now, because they know, I mean, already 90%+ of cars are sold on finance, which is, to all intents and purposes, renting.
Tom, I was going to say, when you say about owning houses, most of us, the banks own the houses.
Yeah.
we're renting off the banks because of the mortgages. But yeah, I mean, you're saying this, and I absolutely love the idea of this. my car's, I've got a hybrid car. It's coming around for renewal, and I can't be asked to know whether to change it, to do. I mean, I want an electric car, but it's because I live in London. We don't have driveways. So to charge a car around here is a nightmare, because you've got to find the lamppost. Half of them don't work, and half of them that you've got cars already plugged in. So it's a disaster. And so, you know, so I'm sticking with the hybrid at the moment. And I would love to just have that subscription and come out and go, where's the car? Or here's the car, or you know, or hold the car for a week, or whatever you want to do with it. You know, I love that concept. I really do. It's so to me that just, I don't know, that really sings to me. I want that now.
Yeah, media led the way. You know, it's, I actually ran the press conference that launched the first legal music downloading service in a previous life, where we got all the major labels together with the technology company. I didn't, but I got the joy of trying to get a load of journalists to a rubbish hotel in London to tell them about this. And we used to talk about this idea of the celestial jukebox, and the phrase always stuck in my head. The idea that one day, rather than buying MP3s, you would just be able to stream any of the songs in the world, wow, anytime, wherever you were. And it was such a pipe dream. Now, of course, there's 93 different services that will sell you access to 35 million songs for 10 quid a month. You know, it's just there.
Yeah, you just rent your music, but you rent every bit of it, because you can have everything. So it's like, you know, which is very hard for modern artists, because they're competing against the Beatles and the Stones and the Specials and everybody else, you know, and Michael Jackson, whoever, because they're all on there. But so I remember Fergal Sharkey was the big one going, if you don't buy music industry will die. And I said this recently on a podcast, I can't remember who to, and I was laughing going, hold on, Fergal, people have been making music for thousands of years, maybe hundreds of thousands of years, I don't know, but they've been making it for thousands at least. And you think, like, selling music was a very short period of time, wasn't it? It was like only 100 years they were selling music, and only really did it get massive from the 70s onwards, and then it kind of died in the end of the last century, you know, where the streaming services came along.
But the business model's changed, you know. It's so much more revenue from live now. You know, so diversity of formats, people getting hungry for vinyl again and stuff. They are actually getting hungry to own stuff and touch stuff and feel stuff. But there are ways for artists to make a living. It's different, but it's still there.
But I suppose also with the rental thing, which makes sense, is, you know, BMW can make sure that every car they've got on the road is environmentally friendly, you know, so it means that we're not driving around in diesel cars, which we were all told to do. And then I bought a diesel car because I was told it was good. Now it turns out that it was crap, and so I went hybrid. But, you know, it means that we can get rid of all the old stock, and we can put the new stock out on the road, and they can do it quicker by recycling it and making sure that, because it's their name on the badge, so they have to, they can't be putting out diesel cars, they're going to have to stick out the latest tech.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's, and, you know, they will design it with the knowledge that they have to recycle it. And we're seeing this in lots of different industries. You know, one of my favorite pieces of work recently was, well, the last couple of years was about steel, you know. And at the moment we puts buildings up with steel, and we weld all the steel together, or rivet all the steel together. And then when we tear the building down, we pull all the steel apart, and sometimes we actually melt it down to make the same things again. And people are now going, hang on a second, we've had Meccano for a long time. Like, why don't we make these buildings out of basically giant Meccano? And when we come to take the building down, rather than, you know, spending loads of energy melting it down and reshaping it, why don't we just unbolt it and reuse the Meccano?
Oh my God, I've had this discussion since that series of documentaries I did with you, and I was hearing all about the Wiki House and stuff like that from all that time ago. I just cannot get my head around why I'm living in a house which is over 100 years old. My neighbor's just about to do her house up, and she said, oh, it's going to take 9 months. I'm like, why can't you just knock it down? I mean, it's a semi-detached, so the neighbors might not like it, might like mine, but why can't we just knock it down and then build a house within a month by buying it in ready-made and make it so, you know, it doesn't leak fuel? And she goes, our houses are so beautiful, pretty. And I'm like, I don't care. They're not practical. I don't drive a 100-year-old car. Why am I living in a 100-year-old house? It's insane that we still feel this way, but the planning permission and everything else, never be able to knock your house down. So we're stuck like this, living in these old-fashioned houses, in old-fashioned towns. I was saying the other day, I cannot believe we would ever get to build something like the Tube again. Can you imagine someone going, now we'll tunnel under London for God knows how many years. I don't even know how many years it took. I think 20 odd years, didn't it, or something. But we're going to tunnel under London. Everyone would go, no way. No, we're not doing that. You know, it wouldn't happen now.
The one that struck me the other day was reservoirs. We went for a walk around a beautiful reservoir, and you know, they flooded a village. They dammed a valley and flooded a village because the city needed water. So do you know what? We're going to flood a load of villages, flood a load of valleys, and we're going to do it, right? And yeah, we'll put some money together, both public and private, mostly private initially. We'll run some pipes miles and miles and miles from these things, places down into Manchester, and build these giant reservoirs. And do you know what? While we're at it, we'll build some boating lakes, and we'll build some parks, and we'll do some nice stuff as well. I cannot fathom that scale of development now. Well, although we can, you know, we are doing it. You know, we are doing. I think CERN is a good example. You know, we built this giant ring of steel under the earth to fire protons at each other because we're curious. I love that we do things like that as a species. I'd like to see us do more. Just on the housing thing, the part of the reason I think we're so attached to houses that are 100 years old, because a lot of the houses that we built in the last 50 are junk. Like, I'm not making a comment on them aesthetically, but like we rented a sort of 1980s house briefly while we were in the middle of moving from one place to another. We were moving from a 1930s house to an 1870s house. And the house we had in the middle was atrocious. It was, you know, a minimum of 50 years newer than both the houses we were moving from and to. And it was junk. It was cold. It was noisy. It was leaking. It was falling apart. And I think, you know, if more of the houses that we built were really cool, really attractive, you know, really different, we might have a different attitude to clinging on to the houses of old.
Agreed. But I reckon if you shot a thermal camera at my house, it would be horrific. And then but if I had a modern house, I could have modern floors, which would capture the energy me walking, turn that back round. I could have a solar panels all over my roofs. You know, the house could make so much energy that it could give back to the system, as we know that that's a possibility. Right, we're running out of time, and I want to get onto one more thing, because this is a thing that all my friends have been talking about recently, and it's only happened very recently. So cryptocurrency, as we know, is here. I think we talked about it last time, and I think it's here to stay. So I read something the other day that it was the fastest moving new technology that has ever been adapted by humans. Whether that's true or not, or just hype, I don't know, but I quite enjoyed listening to that. But the new one on the block is the NFT, the non-fungible
tokens.
Now, I've got two, only because I didn't want to miss out. So I don't know what the hell I was doing, but I was like, well, I'm going to get a couple of those, because everybody's getting them, and I wanted to see what they are. And basically, I've got two pieces of art. Anyone who doesn't know what they are, I've got two pieces of art that only exist on my phone. I can take a picture of them and send them to Tom, and he has a picture of them, but he doesn't own the original. But it goes into music and all sorts of other areas. How would you describe it? Because I'm not doing a very good job, Tom.
You know, when you buy like a print of an artist's work, and you get a numbered print. Now, anybody can look at it. Anybody can buy the postcard. Anybody can buy the poster of it. But you own the numbered print, and it's got a certificate of authenticity, and it's signed by the artist. Now, in this case, the only difference is that certificate of authenticity is digital, and it's signed with cryptography. So it's signed with a load of strings and numbers and letters, basically, that are very, very hard to copy.
Right. And so is there future? I mean, my problem is one of my friends has got, I won't say what it is because it's a bit crass, but she's got a very famous artist picture on her wall that her husband, who sadly passed away now, but bought. It was his pride and joy. And every time I go into her house, I go, oh my God, it's so beautiful. And it's worth a lot of money. And I look at that. Yeah. If it was on her phone, would I give a shit? I'm just not sure I would.
What gives things value, and particularly art value, typically it's scarcity. And so the question for me is, will these things have scarcity value when they are, when, you know, when the let's be honest, those things you've got on your phone, if you send me a picture, it is indistinguishable from the one you've got that's signed.
Yeah, that's like, my problem, yeah.
Nobody's going to know the difference. And that's kind of where my skepticism about these comes from. I think they're a really interesting technology with lots of applications. I mean, this fundamentally, this idea of creating a sort of signed certificate for something that can be traded and moved around. You know, it's great for contracts or bits of property or digital assets or whatever, but I don't know that it's going to have any sort of real longevity. Or rather, it might have longevity, but there might be a bit of a correction to come between hype and reality around the valuations, because some of the valuations and things are pretty absurd.
It's
an interesting tech.
That graphic rock, which went for £1.3 million or something, it's just a graphic rock. It's so, and I've got it on my phone now, and I keep showing it to people and going, "That's worth £1.3 million." Look, because it is. There's no difference between the one I've got on my phone and the one that's in. But I'm sounding like an old man here. That's my problem, because everybody, I've got mates who are waiting up in the middle of the night to buy eggs and things, you know, like NFT eggs and stuff. And it's like, what am I missing? Because I don't want it. So because I don't want it, I want the art in people's houses, but I don't want the NFTs. So that's I think that speaks volumes to me. I'm just not sure.
Look, you know, people used to stay up at night. In fact, people still do stay up at night keeping Tamagotchis alive. You know, I don't think there's an awful lot of difference here in many ways. It's a fad. It's got value because lots of people are doing it. Does that mean you can make money off them? Absolutely. I mean, you can make very real money creating them, selling them, trading them. Does that mean they have any intrinsic value? You know, I don't know that they do. It feels like it might be quite short-lived. And bear in mind, we're talking about a very small number of people doing this. So I've just done some work with a company called Mambu, looking at the banking tribes across the world, like different sort of banking behaviors. And one we call the sort of the neo-asset hoarders. And I think in the UK, it's about 4% of people who've invested in cryptocurrency or NFTs. You know, it's a really, really small percentage of the population still who are doing this. It hasn't, although it gets talked about a lot, hasn't really gone mainstream.
Yeah, but I tell you what, someone said the other day, if you're trying to invest in a cryptocurrency, you're too late, but you're also very early. And I like that scenario, that, you know.
My enduring challenge, sorry, I've just pulled my headphones out. My enduring challenge with cryptocurrency is, what happens if quantum computing can destroy cryptography? So, you know, cryptography is basically based on really, really hard maths problems, right, where the only way to solve the problem is to try every possible combination. It's like, you know, it's like trying to solve a Rubik's cube by trying every possible, you know, combination of moves. And then you get a quantum computer comes along, you can try every possible combination of moves in one go. It can literally try all of them simultaneously. And, you know, no one's really sure if this will happen yet. But there is a possibility that at some point a quantum computer comes along. Bear in mind, you know, given mind, you know, China's moving very fast on these things, and people seem to be quite concerned about China. You know, China creates a quantum computer that can overwhelm the most commonly used standards of cryptographies for signing online banking, for protecting cryptocurrencies, for securing NFTs, and just decides to sort of chuck a hand grenade into the world's economy and just destroy these things overnight. I'm not saying it's gonna happen, but, you know, theoretically, it's not beyond the bounds of possibility.
Oh, that's exciting. I mean, exciting, bad exciting, but maybe good exciting. I don't know. I quite like that. Just finally on the NFTs, the way I see it, and I don't know if you agree with this, when you see kids and they're queuing up outside the Supreme shop, or they used to, or they're queuing outside Nike for the limited edition trainers, that they buy the Supreme shirt, the sweatshirt, then they flip it, they go online and they sell it for 50 quid, they sell it for 500 or 1,000 because it's limited edition. But that sweatshirt, in a few years' time, people are like, Supreme, I'm not into Supreme, I'm into Champion, or, you know, and that is the problem with it. It has a shelf life. And those trainers that I mean, I got a pair of Nike Footscopes years ago for a ridiculous amount of money. They devalued very quickly because people didn't want them anymore. They went out of fashion.
Although, but then do you stick them in the loft for another 20 years and they come back in again?
Maybe.
Yeah, I keep seeing kids walking around in the band t-shirts that I was wearing as a teenager and go, damn it, I wish I'd kept them.
Well, I did keep all my clothes, and I'm digging them out. Started wearing them on Sunday brunch, and people keep taking the mickey out of me, but they're back in fashion. Tom, lovely to speak to you as always. Go to Tom's website, tomcheeseright.com, isn't it? So, yep. Follow him on there. He's always got lots of good stuff.
And if you like the sound of the build-it-yourself EV, I've just set up a YouTube channel as well. So I'm documenting servicing it, fixing it, upgrading it on there. So go have a look at that too.
Is the YouTube channel directed from your website?
Yeah, if you have a look at projects.tc, which is where I'm putting my project stuff.
Tom, thank you so much.
Brilliant. Cheers, Tim.